You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa. Ko Jessica Toku Engua, no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. I'm your host, Jessica, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Olivia. Efai Akine coming up on the show for our regular catch-up. I speak to Green Party co-leader James Shaw about the government's plans to increase benefit sanctions and Israel's ground invasion of Rafah. I talk to local government New Zealand President and Selwyn District Council Mayor Sam Bruton about the government reintroducing referendums on Māori wards. I speak to medical oncologist Dr. George Laking about an initiative which is taking cancer services into Marae and other community centres. And News Team of Faith speaks to Tertiary Education Union organiser Drew Mayhem about union members at UB College of Creative Innovation striking yesterday. Olivia, what have you got for us today?
I speak to musician Jason Parker about the relationship between pop music and queerness in Aotearoa and his event, The Little Gay Inn. And for Get Action this week, I speak to Fairer Future spokesperson Vanessa Cole about our welfare system's restrictive relationship regulations.
Hei aha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of our pieces today. So get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wire mai rane. Give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Ka oa e wariwari. E ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kororo anohi pakihiri roki roki maoranga i te pai tuku tuku. O Irirangi Pōho, mi haere ki 95BFM irakati.com, and you can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
It's time to hear from the Green Party with co-leader James Shaw.
For our weekly catch-up, I spoke to James Shaw about the government's plans to increase benefit sanctions and decrease the rate at which benefits increase annually. We also discussed Israel's ground invasion of Rafah in southern Gaza and Minister of Foreign Affairs Winston Peters meeting with Israel's ambassador to New Zealand this week. The government plans to increase benefit sanctions as well as decrease the rate that benefits increase annually. Can you speak to what you think this will mean in practice for people currently relying on benefits to survive?
Well, it means that people are going to have less money in their pockets and are going to find it harder to keep a roof over their head and put food on the table and look after their kids. It's as simple as that. And it's kind of on brand for the National Party. It's sort of what they've been doing for the last 30 years. But it does mean that we will see both an increase in inequality between those who have the most and those who have the least, and also increasing hardship for those who are at the bottom of the ladder.
Can you tell us why the Green Party opposes benefit sanctions?
Well, at the beginning of our government in 2017, we commissioned an expert advisory group on income support and welfare. One of the things that they found is that actually sanctions tend not to work against their stated objectives, because essentially people kind of get pushed off benefits but without work to go to or other forms of income. And so what it does is it might reduce the number of people who are receiving benefits, but it doesn't actually help get people into work and actually being able to provide a stable income support actually makes it easier for people to go out and look for work. So you know, the kind of the sanctions regime overall was found to increase hardship and you know, put people into abject poverty. And so we object to it on that basis.
Social Development Minister Louise Upston has said Aotearoa has a benefit dependency problem, particularly among young people. Is this something you would agree with?
No, I wouldn't. The issue that we've got is that we've got a very large group of people in this country who, whether they're out of work or even in work, whether they're working part-time or in some cases working multiple jobs, simply aren't earning enough to be able to make ends meet. And so we have a situation here where, you know, just having a job, which is, you know, what National are saying is, look, what we need to do is get people off welfare and into work. The problem is that we've actually got an enormous number of people who have jobs who are still not able to make ends meet. Some of them have got two or three jobs and they're not able to make ends meet. So the simple fact of having a job does not put one above the poverty line in this country. For those people, you need income support to ensure that they can actually make ends meet. You know, National have, the government has recently just put through the smallest increase in the minimum wage in some decades at a time of, you know, quite high inflation. That is going to ensure that people just, you know, that wages are not rising in line with the costs that people face. And so, again, you're just seeing, I think, what is quite a punitive regime being brought back in by this government, which will mean that we have increasing poverty and increasing inequality in this country.
How would the Green Party, if in government, better alleviate poverty in Aotearoa?
Well, we fought an entire election campaign on this. You know, we put out a proposal that essentially the, you know, people with the kind of most wealth in the country, the sort of top 5%, would pay a bit more in tax, and that would enable 95% of New Zealanders to pay less income tax. That would help with their costs, and that would be more money in their pockets than the National Party were proposing for theirs, and it's skewed towards those on lowest incomes, which is, of course, where we need the most support. And we wanted to bring in a regime which is much simpler and straightforward for people who need that income support as well. So, you know, I mean, our orientation has been that actually, you know, if we can provide people with the support that they need, to provide stable homes, stable communities, stable incomes, and so on, then what that means is that they are freed up to be able to advance themselves in other ways, you know, whether that's through work or, you know, education and so on.
I also wanted to talk to you about recent developments in Gaza. So we've seen Israel has launched a ground offensive on Rafah in southern Gaza. What is your response to this?
Well, it's horrific, and I think people all over the world and here in Aotearoa, you know, if you're watching the news and seeing some of those appalling images of what is going on, you know, it is quite clear that Israel is acting in a way that is completely disproportionate. And, you know, according to the recent International Court of Justice finding, is at risk of genocide. And so, you know, I think New Zealand, we're kind of a bit late to the party on this. You know, we're starting to make some noise about this, but actually, you know, we really do need to, you know, both on our own and with other countries, really increase the pressure on the government of Israel to, put in place a ceasefire, make sure that we've got humanitarian aid in there, put in peacekeepers, and so on, because the cost that is being visited on the people of Gaza and now Rafah in Gaza is horrendous.
We saw that the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Winston Peters, expressed concern about this ground offensive. He also met with Israel's ambassador to New Zealand to discuss the New Zealand-Israel relationship. Do you think this is appropriate, and should we expel Israel's ambassador to New Zealand?
Well, the thing that you know we've been saying for some time is that New Zealand has, in the past, led the world when it comes to trying to coordinate international action to prevent genocide from happening. And I was asking the Prime Minister about this in the House a couple of weeks ago to say, you know, under Article 1 of the Convention, you know, we have a duty as a country to intervene before a genocide happens to try and prevent it from happening. And, you know, back in the 1990s, for example, we led the call around the world when it came to the impending genocide in Rwanda, and really marshaled the United Nations to, you know, and the countries of the world to sort of come together to try and prevent that. So it sort of feels like, you know, we're kind of starting to make some noise here, but the, you know, if you just, again, if you look at the pictures of what's going on in Rafah and other parts of Gaza at the moment, it is a humanitarian catastrophe, and it is completely disproportionate. And you know, I think it really is incumbent upon the New Zealand government to do everything it can, you know, both, you know, standing as our own, on our own two feet, but also working with other countries around the world to try and stop this from getting any worse.
And that was Green Party co-leader James Shaw on the government increasing benefit sanctions, as well as their response to Israel launching a ground invasion of Rafah in southern Gaza.
That was James Shaw for the Green Party. The Wire.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Yesterday, union members at UB College of Creative Innovation campuses across the Motu went on strike for 4.5 hours after failed collective agreement negotiations that have been ongoing since September 2022. News team of FAFE spoke to tertiary education union organiser Drew Mayhem about why their members chose to take strike action.
So what led the TEU members at UB to the strike?
We've been in negotiations for a new collective agreement in September last year. We've had about 4 different bargaining meeting sessions where we've met with the employer. And for the past 2 sessions at least, there just hasn't been any progress made around the negotiating table. The employer simply says, oh, we're thinking about our response. And that's not actually engaging in a negotiation. Our members are incredibly frustrated. They haven't actually had a negotiated pay increase since 2021. It's been a while. And, of course, they've all supported the organisation through that COVID time. And, you know, we know that inflation has been rampant for the past couple of years as well. And, quite frankly, our members have had enough and sick of being disrespected. So they do not take this action lightly.
And what outcome are the union members hoping for?
We're hoping to get back around the negotiating table with actually UB responding to our claims with an actual offer, because, you know, we, or at least engaging with us to actually negotiate any of the outstanding issues that we've tabled as our claims. But at the moment, they're doing neither.
What is your message to UB on behalf of your members?
UB, you're a hugely profitable organisation. You're part of a much bigger umbrella organisation called UB Education, and we believe that our members deserve a proper salary offer, and at the moment you're disrespecting us in bargaining by not actually negotiating.
That was Tertiary Education Union organiser Drew Mayhem on why their members took strike action against UB College of Creative Innovation.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te Wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
It's that good of who we are. Wake up. yesterday like Eeyore. Thank you for everything. I'm up to slay away all that Enor energy. Feeling okay in the fallet of my psyche. Healing in peace, this Odepua growing. Hitting with the beautiful brown eyes. Natural dark hair, ooze looking all nice. Brown in my skin to bring that spice. No shame in the game, I'll say that twice. Hitting with the beautiful brown eyes. Natural dark hair, ooze looking all nice. Brown in my skin to bring that spice. No shame in the game, I said that twice. These city lights in the CBD. These city lights in the CBD. Flashing by pretty girls in the city. Vibe all night, go on, get down, get busy.
This a pretty girl club with the bad man, what he need. Triple bits to stand proud, cause we know what's up. Pretty girls rise up, guts boys show up. You already know who about to turn up. Urban needles don't know how to stop. Pop it up, but just pop, block and drop. Never ever let that energy flop. Self-love, help me get right on top.
Nobody's watching, and if they are, they might start catching. Phillies for the B and W, yeah, that's me. Too busy for the jumper, they won't snatch me. I thought I got to eat it representing the fun I know we are, thought of the CBD. Shout out to my crew, true as can be. Roll with my click down Courtney. 545 up and down the country, doing what we do. Best we stay hungry. Big plans from above, give me the money. We walk, I talk, you can't trust me. I'm too to catch you recognize. The bad man, I want he near. In real life, they told me, yeah, I'm a real nice size. For a told that I knew I'm big enough for that ride. Ain't it with the beautiful brown eyes, natural dark hair, ooze looking all nice. Proud of my skin, I bring that spice. No shame in the game, said that three times. Wake up today like Eeyore, thank you for everything. I'm up to slay away all that Enor energy. Feeling okay in the fillet of my psyche. Healing in peace, this Odepua growing. These city lights in the CBD. These city lights in the CBD. Flashing by pretty girls in the city. Vibe all night, go on, get down, get busy.
This a pretty girl club. This a pretty girl club. This a pretty girl club.
And 95 BFM present 3070's groundbreaking lead singer Alicia Joy at Neck of the Woods, Saturday, March 23rd. Off the back of a world tour, Melbourne's Alicia Joy debuts Tamaki Makaurau with her unique mix of new jazz and soul. Alicia Joy with Hudge and Christoph El Chirento in support at Neck of the Woods, Saturday, March 23rd. Get your tickets from ticketfairy.com.
Love is in the air at MOTAT for Pride Comedy Night on Valentine's Day, February 14th.
Let your heart soar in the Aviation Hall as you enjoy lots of laughs with whatever cutie you choose. In a night of comedy hosted by Tom Sainsbury.
Featuring an amazing lineup of Kiwi comedians, including Abby Howells, David Stewart and Brinley Stent.
Tickets are limited, so get in quick.
Pride Comedy Night, February 14th, 6:30 p.m. Get your tickets at motat.nz.
Thanks a lot.
It's nice to be back.
Play some Slayer.
Yeah, real original.
yourself. So.
Jukebox Parlor is taking all your requests, and we know you have requests.
She came from planet.
Jukebox Parlor with your host Jen. Saturday 7 till 9 pm. Right here on 95BFM.
Bang! Pow!
It's Get Action, The Wire's weekly check-in with Action Station Aotearoa.
Welcome back to The Wire. Our welfare system has regulations surrounding relationships, which can greatly impact the amount of welfare entitlement they receive. A person's benefits can be greatly reduced if they are in a relationship which includes casual dating. Many have criticized these regulations, saying it prevents people from entering relationships due to fears of losing their benefits and risks trapping people in unsafe relationships due to forced financial dependence. I spoke to Fairer Future spokesperson and Action Station campaigner Vanessa Cole about the issues with these regulations and the action the government should take. Could you explain how the welfare system currently deals with relationships? Like, what are the current rules in place?
The current MSD and study link relationship rules determine the amount of income support you get based on your partner's income. So unlike the tax system in ACC, which regard people as individuals, if you are assessed as being in a relationship in the nature of marriage, you might lose some or all of your income. Work and income and study link staff have discretion, but kind of use this ridiculous set of criteria to determine what a relationship is, which includes you live together, you share responsibilities such as bringing up children, you socialise and holiday together, you share money, you share household bills. And apart from the criteria around sexual relationship, a lot of this could just mean flatmates or friends or people that you live with. We see these relationship rules as archaic and outdated, and that's why on Valentine's Day we're launching this campaign to overhaul them and to individualise income support.
What are the impacts of this policy on people, and why does Fairer Future think these rules need to be overhauled?
So what these relationship rules mean in practice is that people who start dating someone, start giving emotional support to each other or stay at each other's houses are having their income support cut, often after just 6 weeks. And this means not only that people avoid getting into relationships because of fear of losing their financial independence, but also people who enter into relationships and have their income support cut risk being trapped in unsafe relationships with no financial means to leave. It places people in situations where a very new partner is your only means of financial support, which can be actually very dangerous. Also, if you do not declare your relationship and MSD or study link determines that you are in a relationship, you can have your benefit cut and be subjected to very unfair interrogation tactics and be criminalised by the system. We believe that benefit levels are already too low and taking away people's income is unfair and causes hardship.
What is the Let Love Thrive campaign and what are your specific events about?
So our campaign being launched on Valentine's Day is us calling on the government to stop all investigations of people receiving income support, first of all, pending the reform of relationship rules, to increase the couple rate to double the single rate, and to ultimately have full individualisation of income support. Nobody is penalised for being in love and being in a relationship. So the Fairer Future Coalition has run several events. So we had a card writing at Auckland Women's Centre on Monday, which dozens of people attended and wrote letters to the government calling on them to change MSD and StudyLink relationship rules. We've had students in Pōneke run card writing sessions and also hold a big heart outside of MSD calling on shift in partner income, which impacts on people's access to student allowance and other supports.
What actions are you calling on the government to take in this area?
As I mentioned before, we're really calling on the government to take steps in changing the MSD relationship rules, but ultimately to fully individualise income support so people have access to income support whether they're in a relationship or not. And before that, some steps that the government can take is actually to stop the investigations into people who are seen to be in a relationship in the nature of marriage, which are causing harm, and the interrogation tactics that are being used are unfair and and invasive. And so this is one step to take on the journey to full individualisation.
Is there any way people can learn more about this issue and your campaign and also get involved?
Of course. So we actually have a petition on the Action Station platform calling an open letter to Prime Minister Christopher Luxon calling on change to welfare relationship rules. That people signing that petition can then be linked into the campaign for further actions in the future. People can also follow the Sarah Future Instagram account where we'll be posting updates about the campaign and different ways for people to get involved.
The way that the welfare system deals with relationships, how does that compare with overseas jurisdictions and governments?
I guess a lot of different countries tend to have particular ways in which they treat relationships in their welfare systems, but our system, like a lot of systems, are based on really old school patriarchal understandings of welfare, which see a family as a nuclear family with a single breadwinner. And this is just not the reality of relationships today, and it's certainly not the reality of our economic conditions in which many households rely on multiple incomes to survive. So this is a kind of way of looking at welfare that is international, and lots of countries experience these kind of very old school understandings of relationships and of welfare, and we need to be expanding our understanding of relationships and to ensure everyone has a livable income and can live with dignity and can thrive.
Is there anything else you would like to add?
Yeah, just that these relationship rules are really unfair and outdated, and a lot of people experience this when they interact with the welfare system, and we want to support as many people to be involved in this campaign to overhaul these relationship rules and so that people can have fair income and be able to thrive in their communities.
That was Fairer Future spokesperson and Action Station campaigner Vanessa Cole talking about the issues with the current welfare relationship regulations.
Wow, important stuff.
That was Get Action on 95BFM.
Well, what a phenomenal thing for you to say.
The Wire.
Cancer is coming close to taking over from heart disease as Aotearoa's number one killer. In response to this, a new initiative is aiming to take cancer services out of hospitals and into marae and other community settings. I spoke to medical oncologist Dr. George Laking about this. Can you tell our listeners about your cancer services initiative?
Yeah, so where I work in cancer services, the specialist part of that, we've tended to base it around the treatment of cancer. But if you think about cancer itself and people's journey with cancer, there's a much bigger spectrum than just the treatment part. Begins with prevention, goes into screening, diagnosis, then you get into treatment. Beyond treatment, there's aftercare, follow-up, and indeed end of life. All these things come into the realm of cancer. I've been working as a doctor who gives people chemotherapy. Nowadays also targeted treatments and immune therapy. I've been doing this in Auckland for the last 16 years. And when I meet people for the first time, they tell me about the story of their journey to come to where I work looking for cancer treatment. And it's often quite a long journey, negotiating Auckland traffic and traffic jams and parking buildings. But even bigger than that, the diagnosis part of it that people tell me about, it's often been quite delayed, meaning that by the time people actually are able to have treatment, their cancer's more advanced than you'd really want, and sometimes, you know, not even able to be cured. I would tend to say I'm sorry to hear about that arduous journey to arrive for treatment, but of course all I do as a cancer specialist is treat cancer. I'm not really involved in any of the earlier stages. But I think what I've come to feel, and a lot of my colleagues have come to feel, is that we don't really feel happy about the situation because cancer is the thing that we care about, and so we'd like to have a part to make sure that the whole journey works well for people, not just the treatment part, but that things like prevention, screening, diagnosis, all those aspects are working well for people with cancer. And One of the things we realised was to be able to be effective in that way, it was important for us to actually be more present out in the community where all these things are actually happening. We've tended to be shut away inside one single hospital in the Auckland region without a lot of involvement in or connection with the community, where all these ever so important parts of the cancer journey, prevention, screening, diagnosis, aftercare, are happening. So that's been a motivation for us to think, well, how could we take our work that we do beyond the hospital, more into the community, and maybe start to have a bit of a role to also help make sure the system as a whole and the journey as a whole works better for people affected by cancer.
What are some of the advantages of offering cancer services outside of hospitals, particularly for Māori?
I think for anyone, it's the less travel that you personally have to do, the more convenient that is. In general, I think one of the things that Māori say, he tangata Māori hoki a hau, he uri a hau a te whakatohia, tēnā tātou. One of the things that Māori talk about, of course, is tūranga wāwai, which is that sense of having a place or a location where you go, where you feel strong, and it's your place and where you find your strength. And coming into the hospital, a lot of the time for many people, bit of an alien place, bit of a different place. Sometimes whānau have had experiences at the hospital that haven't been so good. So if we flip things around and go out to where people have their own strengths and their own networks and their own connections, then that's a lot more likely to get things off to a good start with what we're about and what we're doing in that journey through cancer.
What will cancer services in Marae and other places outside of hospitals look like?
So, and this is the thing where, to some extent, I've got to be up front, we're probably even a bit of a latecomer because if you visit Marae, you'll often find that alongside Marae are hauora, primary healthcare settings, distinctively Māori primary healthcare settings, and having been and visited hauora, these are very recognisable primary healthcare settings, very frequently what we recognise as general practice or family medicine healthcare settings, clinic rooms. You see your doctors, your nurses, your other healthcare professionals, but they're on site in the community, alongside Marae frequently, or more generally primary healthcare settings, GP practices in the community.
How can people know when and where you'll be offering these services?
Yeah, that's a good question. How to find out the next step? Well, one of the things that we have, of course, is if we make an appointment, we already have a way of sending a message to people about where their appointment is going to be. At present, you can get like a letter or an email or a text that says, well, come along to Auckland City Hospital or Green Lane Clinical Centre, for example. Only in this situation, we'll be able to send out a message which says, well, come along to your local hauora or Marae Clinic, for example. More generally, as we start to be more present in this way, we want to put out messages around the community. In fact, that's another part of the vision that we have, is just to be more generally present in the community, because you know, it's possible to have a presence in the community that's even beyond clinical appointments by just fronting up to community meetings, for example, and that's valuable when you're getting into those bigger topics about prevention, screening, diagnosis, what treatment offers. Generally increasing community understanding about these things so that when the time arrives and people need care, they're already knowledgeable and already prepared for that. We think there's just a big advantage in being generally present in the community, spreading the word about these things. They talk about something called health literacy, and we feel that as specialists, we can bring something, you know, along those lines in terms of just spreading the word about how we work, what we do, where we are, and the reasons why.
That was all the questions that I had, unless was there anything else you wanted to add?
So thanks for coming with those questions. I just wanted to add that you know, you might say why now, why would it take 16 years of me personally working in a clinic to realise things had got to the point where we needed to make a change so the system as a whole works better for people. One of the things that has come along to, I think, really prompt us into some action is the building that we're in at the hospital is reaching the end of its cycle, and we've realised actually we need to look for some new infrastructure to do our work in anyway. So this was a opportunity for us to take a look at how we do our work and what we call our model of care, because the physical setting that we've been using for the last 40 years or so is approaching the end of its useful life. So that's kind of been the trigger for us in a project that we call the Integrated Cancer Service, which is about refreshing the physical surroundings where we do our care and actually redesigning the model of care that we have so that it can work better for communities.
And that was medical oncologist Dr. George Laking discussing the initiative to make cancer services more accessible. And we'll be right back after this quick break.
Me. Blanco White is soaring to New Zealand for the first time ever to deliver a cosmic performance at the Tuning Fork this Friday, February 16th. In the fresh light of his new album Tarifa, a record that embraces colourful fusions of folk, Indian electronics, Blanco White gets set to enthrall in New Zealand. Blanco White at the Tuning Fork this Friday, February 16. Tickets from MoshTix.
Fill up your ears with some red hot chats.
Podfest is coming to Q Theatre this February. Catch fantastic podcasts live. Tickets from $20 per show, including
Wellington Paranormal, the podcast with Karen O'Leary and Mike Minogue.
Rats in the Gutter with Johanna Cosgrove and Sam Takani.
Timprovise presents Honest to Who?
Podfest at Q, February 7th to 18th. For tickets and more info, go to podfest.co.nz.
What's a seven-letter word for Street Fighter?
Brawler.
Hey, what's happening at Ponsonby Social Club this week?
Botica Beats with Enrique Morales and Gustavo Ferreira, with support from DJ Bobby Brazuca.
And tomorrow,
DJs Luca and Katia.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
It's returning! 95BFM blessings are looming. Get ready to be bestowed with big beats, big sweats, and big times. It's back! The B-Rave 2.0. B-Rave. B-Rave 2.0.
Featuring
Babyface Killer, AJ Honeysuckle, Versetti, Nalo Liafi, and one, Mr. Meaty Boy, and Current Bias.
BFM and Under the Radar present the B-Rave 2.0, Saturday, March 2nd at the Mothership. Tickets available now at undertheradar.co.nz. Thanks to Scrumpy, fresh for the bite.
The coalition government is proposing to re-establish... Apologies, welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Let me just introduce that piece. The coalition government plans to make Māori wards go through a referendum process. Previously, Māori wards could be overturned by a referendum, but this rule did not apply to any other wards. I spoke to Local Government New Zealand President and Samoa District Council Mayor Sam Bruton about their opposition to this. Referenda on Māori wards and constituencies. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, we think it's a step backwards for local government. We don't see the need for it and think that it unfairly picks on Māori wards. At the moment, councils are able to make decisions on which wards and constituencies should be at each election, with some choosing to have Māori wards and some not choosing to have Māori wards. We believe that the council table is the right place to make that decision and to seek referendum on that, or on any decisions that councils end up making, just add costs and complexity to the issue, and as a distraction from the stuff that local government really needs to be focused on.
For those who may not know, can you tell our listeners about the process of establishing Māori wards and constituencies, and also removing referenda on Māori wards?
Yeah, so every 6 years, a local council goes through representation review. It can be done sooner than that, but it must be done every 3 years. And through that process, they determine how many councillors there should be, how many wards, or if there should be elections at large, whether there should be Māori wards, the type of voting system, first past the post, or STV voting. So there's a number of things raised, and all that's done in consultation with the community. So there's input from the community and from Mana Whenua through that process. Whether or not there's Māori wards was an option given back in 2001. So the government's already decided that Māori wards are fine to have at the council level. And so yeah, we just think councils should be left to get on with that work. My council's going through that at the moment. Ngāi Tahu and our local Runanga don't want Māori wards, and so we haven't pursued that. For others around the country, in consultation with Mana Whenua, they do really want those Māori wards, and they have been implemented. And that's meant we've seen an increase up to about 20% of elected members now identifying as Māori, which is a lift from 14% 3 years ago. That has obviously improved over that time.
These rules, if implemented, would only apply to Māori wards and constituencies. Would you say that this is undemocratic?
I think that's why we're saying it's unfair. Either referendum should apply to all of it, which we don't support. or apply to none of it, rather than singling out Māori wards as that the one piece for the referendum. We've seen a poll conducted from Taupō, I think it was about 3 years ago. It cost nearly $100,000. So, you know, like, there's extra costs that communities, I don't think, should be having to pay, and councils are more than capable of making the decision to or not to have Māori wards.
And if the government does decide to go through with this, what action plan do you have in response to this?
Local government should work within the legislation of the country, so we've let the government know where we stand on it. At the end of the day, they are the government. They make the rules up for the nation, and so local government will abide by the legislation that is set before it.
That was Local Government New Zealand President and Selwyn District Council Mayor Sam Bruton on their opposition to reintroducing referendums on Māori wards.
You know, our call is fuck normal. Sorry, I swore. It's important.
That's okay, it's BFM.
Wire. Queer musicians have a unique relationship with pop music, especially here in Aotearoa, where the queer pop music scene is thriving. Musician Jason Parker, who has just released his first EP, How to Be Lonely, is producing The Little Gay Inn, a live showcase to celebrate queer music and build the community. I talked to Jason about his personal experience with pop music, the history of queer pop music, and the importance of queer music events. Could you tell our listeners a bit about yourself and the music you produce and your personal journey as a musician?
Yeah, so my name is Jason Parker and I make pop music. I've been making pop music for the last 2 years. I just released my first EP of 5 songs at the end of 2022 called How to Be Lonely, which was like a big journey of figuring out how to release music on my own. I was on a show called Pop Stars like in 2020 and I got eliminated. Very, very quickly, and in my mind, I was going to win the whole thing. So when I got home, I was very shocked by this news. So I was like, I have to do this myself. I've never felt so connected to something. So since then, I've just been figuring out how to write my own music, release my own music, and spread joy to the world.
How has your queer identity influenced your music and your experience in the music industry in Aotearoa?
Hugely. I wear my queer identity on my sleeve. Like it's something I am really proud of, and it's something that has allowed me to move through the world in like a very present way. It's something I always can connect back to, my queer identity. And I guess with music, I grew up listening to Christina Aguilera and Kelly Clarkson and Shania Twain and Celine Dion, like the divas. I always say this, but like, When a queer person is born, they get the honour to choose one diva to stan above all others, and it's just like really nice to have that to connect to. And with my music, I just want to recreate that same feeling that I had listening to these people when I was a kid. They were like my best friends, you know? Growing up in a small town, you don't really meet many people. Well, I didn't meet many queer people. And so pop stars were my, like, friends.
How would you describe the ongoing relationship between pop music and queerness in Aotearoa?
I'm producing this show at the moment called Little Gay Inn, which is a queer music showcase. I was going out to a lot of gigs in Aotearoa, like, especially around Tamaki, and I love going to live shows, and we're just realising that maybe, like, there weren't a lot of queer people in the audience and potentially in the bands or shows as well. It was very straight-dominated spaces. Not saying that that was a bad thing at all. It was just like an observation I had made. So I wanted to create a space for queer people to come and, like, steal queer joy and power. And I think there's a long way to go with the queer music scene in Aotearoa, but there is one, and I feel really passionate about bringing that to more people.
How do you feel queer music in Aotearoa compares with the rest of the world?
I think New Zealand, like Aotearoa, makes some of the best music in the world, personally, and I will die on that hill. And that includes queer music. Like, we make some really, really great queer music. We had some really great queer artists, like Anika Moore, for example. She is just really someone who I look up to and someone who I think is a really great representation of a queer person doing the thing in Te Reo and beyond. So I just want to see more of it. I want to see more people being celebrated for their queerness and more people going out to celebrate queerness as well.
Can you tell us about the events of Little Gayen and more about it?
Yeah, so I started Little Gayen last year, but basically based off what I just said before about wanting a space for queer people to meet an audience, a queer audience or an ally audience, I guess. And so I created this event called Little Gayen. It's a queer music showcase where three or four artists get up on stage and they just do their own thing. So I create pop music. This Little Gayen, we've got Ariel Woese, who is like singer-songwriter. She's honestly got the most amazing voice. And Babe Martin, who makes like ethereal, Lana Del Rey-esque type music. And all these people identify in the rainbow community. And it's just a place for them to have their moment.
What is the importance of Little Gayen both to you and the queer music community?
I think it's important to celebrate queer artists and it's important to be visible as a queer person. A lot of my life I've had people say to me, like, why do you have to be so gay? Like, why do you make being gay your whole personality? And to that I say, because it's fun. It's joyous. After a Little Gayen, the feeling that the audience gets is like, wholesome and loving, and it's nice with people to connect with each other and create a community and create whānau. So that's the importance of it for me.
How can people find out more about Little Gayen?
Well, you can go to the Auckland Pride website, or you can go on my Instagram account or my website. It's at it's Jason Parker on everything, all social media. But it is this Friday the 16th at Big Fan in Morningside, and the doors are at 7:30, and you can get tickets from Under the Radar.
Is there anything else you would like to add?
Happy Pride!
That was musician Jason Parker on the relationship between queerness and pop music and his event on Friday, the Little Gay Inn.
Happy Pride!
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, ne te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wednesday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us. And thanks to Olivia, our producer. Ni rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou I whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Caitlin.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.